All right, I figured I'd start with some good news because we are in Daniel 11 tonight, and it's tough. Some of you might hate me by the time we're done here. But just to give you an idea, and so you're not really upset, is I did a verse-by-verse rundown of this entire thing. We are not covering the entire 45 verses tonight in that sense, in that much detail, because when I was done, I had 99 slides. And you'd never let me come up here and preach again if I gave you 99 slides, because we'd all be late going to bed tonight before the first day of school. So we'll do some flyover type stuff in some of these verses because we just don't have time to cover everything. And if you are one of those history nerds that likes that sort of thing, I do have the slides saved as this sermon, the extended edition, on my drive. The director's cut, and you can get that at a later date. Just let me know, and I will send you all 99, 100 slides that I have, and you can go through all the Ptolemies and all those guys that are going to come up in the middle of the chapter. So we're going to try to cover the stuff I think is that will really matter to us in the long run, or maybe it won't, but you know, it's stuff that I think is the most important part of the chapter. Okay, so here's your basic outline of chapter 11. Notice we have 45 verses. 1 through 20 covers the rest of the Persian Empire, okay, the Greek Empire, and then when the Greek Empire splits into the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. That's what 1 through 20 is. Then we pick up in verse 21 through about verse 35, and that focuses in on one man, one leader, Antiochus the IV, Epiphanes. He's the we covered him back when we did chapter 8. He is the type for the Antichrist. He is the one that will do an abomination of desolation there at the temple. He is the one that will persecute the Jews there in Israel and turn his wrath upon Jerusalem. And then we've got 36 to 45, and depending on who you talk to, that could refer either to still Antiochus or a future king, or maybe both. You know, it's one of those kind of things because Daniel doesn't break in the prophecy. In fact, we're jumping in kind of right in the middle of sort of a thing, even though we're going in 11 verse 1. Because it says in chapter 11 verse 1, also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to conform and to strengthen him. Well, who is the I? Well, we have to go all the way back to Daniel 10, chapter 10 and 11, or verses 10 and 11, where it says, remember when Pastor Sean preached on this, the angel that came, remember he had just seen possibly the pre-incarnate Christ, and he had been knocked on his face, and then he feels a hand on his shoulder and lifts him up. That goes all the way back there. Behold, a hand touched me and was set me upon my knees and upon the palms of my hands, and he said unto me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto thee. It's the same I. It's the same angel speaking to Daniel here in chapter 11. Okay, so whether it's the exact same time or a continuation, same angel is speaking to him in this prophecy. So this is not Daniel speaking, this is an angel speaking when we're going through chapter 11. Verse 2 says, and now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. So here's what we've got to get from this whole thing. Remember that when Daniel got this prophecy, it was still future. Okay? For us, it's different, and this is what makes it so difficult to preach through a chapter like this, is because for us, it's not future, unless the very end maybe, but a lot of this is not future, it's already happened. And so for us, it's Daniel said this, or the angel said this, and then it came to pass exactly as the angel said it would come to pass. So for us, it's pure history. You know, and chapter 8 was the same way. But for Daniel, this is still in the future. So to understand what's going on, you've really got to take yourself back and try to put yourself pre-vision here, pre all this history starting to happen, and realize if somebody told you and laid out the next 20 years of United States history, and then all of a sudden you lived through all that, not that Daniel's going to live through all that, but the Jews that lived through all that and see all this stuff come to pass exactly as the prophecy were to take place, right? That'd be pretty amazing to experience that. And that's what the Jews are going to experience. So he says there's going to be three more kings in Persia and then a fourth that's going to be more rich. Well, here's what happens. Cyrus the Great captures Babylon in 539 BC, and then That's who he's under when he gets the prophecy, if we're getting the prophecy in 538. And there shall stand up three more kings. Well, Cyrus's son is named Cambyses II. He rules from 530 to 522. Smerdis is this kind of pretender king that comes up and rules for about a year in 522. And then he's followed by Darius the Great, which is 521 to 486. Darius is probably the one you recognize in that group. The other two guys are pretty minor in the scheme of things. And then the fourth shall be richer than they all. That is Xerxes. Okay, or Ahasuerus, or Ahasuerus, or however you want to pronounce that. And where do we know him from? The book of Esther. Okay, so put that in your time frame. Esther happens right in the middle of this whole thing. Okay, and by his strength, by Xerxes' strength, those riches he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Well, Xerxes rebelled against Greece. Xerxes went, well, I guess rebel is the right word because they were the ones that were in power. But he went up and tried to crush Greece. He burns Athens to the ground, and he attempts to go even a little bit further, and he eventually suffers defeat at Salamis. And that came to mind this morning, because if you saw the map that Pastor Sean put up in the Acts, they're right there on Cyprus. You see that dot right there that was Salamis. I don't know if anybody was paying attention to that, but it's right there. Trust me. Go back and look at the slides, and you will see it. I just noticed it because I remember writing it on my own slide. Verse 3 says, "And a mighty king shall stand up." So Persia will fight against Greece, right? And he'll be put back a little bit. "And then a mighty king will stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will." Well, based on what we know from chapter 8, who is this great king from Greece? This is Alexander the Great. Okay, Alexander the Great will rule live from 356 to 323. He'll rule from about 334 to 323. And obviously, we've talked a lot about Alexander the Great, right? Alexander the Great is he's the torso of the statue in Daniel 2. And the rest of the empire. He's the leopard in chapter 7. He's the goat, or at least the horn on the goat in chapter 8. Everybody with us now? All these great images that are going on in Daniel? That's Alexander and the Greek Empire. Remember, that's Alexander's empire. It stretched from Greece all the way to India. Okay? Just an unbelievable amount of land in a very short amount of time. He was a prodigy, a wunderkind, if you will, of fighters. And he ends up winning all this stuff. He gets Egypt and all that as well. He is one of the great leaders there in the early world there. So 11:4. "And when he shall stand up," when Alexander shall stand up, "when that mighty king shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others besides those." So if you remember again, chapter 8, when Alexander dies, he has no heir, and his kingdom is split four ways by four different generals, and eventually two of those generals come out on top, and they are the two top guys, and they will be the ones that are kind of fighting over land. Remember, Israel's the 50-yard line in that whole thing. The Ptolemies are in Egypt. The Seleucids are up here in mainland, and they're fighting back and forth over the land. Okay? So when Alexander died, there we go. After 7 years of internal struggle, the conquered territory was divided into four sections under the control of four generals, which takes us back to Daniel 8. "Therefore, the he-goat waxed very great." That's Greece. "When he was strong, the great horn was broken." That's Alexander. "And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power." So they will not be as strong. There will be four Greek kingdoms under the Greek banner, but they will be nowhere near as strong as Alexander was to start with. Okay? You with me so far? Okay? So there is what happens, and this is where it lays out. This red or maroon or whatever you want to say here, this is the Seleucid Empire. Okay, the Seleucid Empire, the yellow or the gold down here is the Ptolemaic Empire, the Ptolemies. So the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, named after the two generals, Ptolemy and Seleucus. Okay, they're the ones that originally, Seleucus was a general of Ptolemies, and he sent him up to take some land up in Babylon, and Seleucus took the land and then kept it for himself. They were like best buds, and then all of a sudden he turned on his buddy, and now they're fighting. That's what goes on here. And it's going to last for several hundred years. Okay, again, with Israel kind of being in the middle of the whole thing. Okay, once friends became bitter enemies, their descendants, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, continued that hostility, engaged in many wars, and Palestine was kind of the battlefield, the prize. That was what they were always trying to get. The Ptolemies hold Palestine and Israel for the first half of this thing, and it's actually pretty good. They're very tolerant of the Jews. The Jews have good success. They're prosperous under them. The Septuagint is written during that time. There's a lot of good things that happen to Israel when the tide shift and the Seleucids take control, they're the ones that are going to heavily persecute the Jews. So two Greek kingdoms that rule Israel, one that's pretty nice to them, the other one that's awful to them. And that's where Antiochus will come in and all that. So the next 15 verses are what we're going to kind of jump right over. Okay? And if you saw the slides, you'll understand, because all these guys have the same name. It's like Ptolemy 1, Ptolemy 2, Ptolemy 3, Ptolemy 4, it just goes down the line. Okay? And they're all Antiochus up north. They're just going back and forth, and it's kind of hard to keep track of. And it's not exactly a well-known period of history. It's one thing when we're talking about Alexander. It's another thing when we're talking about Ptolemy the Third. I mean, nobody knows who that is, right? So, again, if you want it, let me know. I'll send you the uncut version, and you can look at all that stuff. But basically what we've got here, and the amazing thing about it, and I don't want to shortchange this, is that each verse pertains to specific things that are happening in history. And if you go back and look at the history, it's exactly as it says, which is why all the skeptics say, well, this had to be written later. It's way too accurate. But you can literally read verse 5, go to the history and see what happened. Read verse 6, go to the history and see what happens. And it's talking about marriages and alliances and failed invasions. And it's just a couple hundred years of history of all that stuff. Okay, and I won't waste your time with that tonight. But if you want it, let me know. I'll send it to you. Okay, so let's get to verse 21. That's where we kind of want to pick up. And we'll read that, and then we'll start taking that apart verse by verse. All right, verse 21. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. And after the league made with him, or the deal, or the covenant made with him, he shall work deceitfully. For he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. He shall enter peaceably, even upon the fattest places of the province. He shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. All right, time out. 30 seconds. Okay, king of the north, Seleucids. King of the south, Ptolemies. It doesn't matter who it is, they call them the same thing. Okay, so in verse 20, the king of the north is this guy, but in verse 25, the king of the north is his great-great-grandson. Okay, it's the same line. So when they say that, it's just a change in period, but it's the same thing. All right, play ball. Where'd we leave off? What verse are we on? 26, all right. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain, and both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Do you see how this is difficult? Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant. That should sound familiar to what we talked about in chapter 8. And he shall do exploits and return to his own land. At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south. And it shall not be as the former or as the latter. For the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant. That's Antiochus coming back to Israel. We'll talk about that. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with him that forsake the holy covenant, and arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that makes desolate. Okay, just another point on that. Remember, Jesus talks of an abomination that makes desolate that is yet to happen. So we've got at least two of those. Okay, that's this guy has done that. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits, and they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with a little help, a good King James sentence, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries, and some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. Now, if you read it that fast, you're probably not going to get what's going on there. That's something you kind of have to pore over. But that's the section we're going to try to cover here. So we're jumping right into the middle of the history between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Okay? Then we'll get into Antiochus, and hopefully that'll start resonating a little bit when we get there. Okay, so 21, in his estate shall stand up a vile person. Somebody vile is going to come up in this kingdom to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flattery. So he's not the heir to the kingdom, but he's going to worm his way in and get the kingdom. Okay, that's verse 21. Well, if we go to the history, Seleucus IV, again, down the line, he is murdered. This happens a lot in these pagan kingdoms, but Seleucus IV is murdered, and his son is named Demetrius. He's supposed to take the throne, but Antiochus IV, who was the son of the previous king, who had been taken hostage to Rome years before, swoops back in and steals the kingdom. Okay, so Antiochus IV gets the kingdom by flattery. He lies his way in there. He worms his way back in there. Okay, and he took for himself the title Epiphanes Theos. That's God manifest, God in the flesh. So when he calls himself Antiochus IV Epiphanes, he's saying Antiochus IV, God in the flesh. Okay, he's got a bit of an ego. And this is the little horn of Daniel 8. This is the little horn that comes out of the great horn back in Daniel 8. That's Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Okay. 22 says, with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Well, Ptolemy VI, so Antiochus IV is from the Seleucid Empire. He's going against Ptolemy VI, and they all have these interesting last names. So they're not last names, but titles that go on the end. So Ptolemy VI is Philometer. That means one who loves his mother. Okay? That is his name. Okay? And so he becomes of age. He attempts to regain the lands of Palestine from the Seleucids, but he's eventually defeated and captured by Antiochus IV. Okay, so he'll be broken. Also, the prince of the covenant, he's going to take the prince captive. Verse 23, and after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. Well, the Egyptians respond by taking Ptolemy VIII. That's his brother, Ptolemy VIII, Physcon. And why do I have that picture up there? Because Physcon means sausage. Apparently, Ptolemy VIII was a little on the chubby side, and they named him Physcon because he was... I'm serious. That was his name. I had to look it up, and I was like, is that for real? That's what they named him. Apparently, it's a Latin word. And that's the brother of Ptolemy VI, and they make him the new king of Egypt. Well, Antiochus has Ptolemy VI in his pocket. He's captured him, and he says, well, I'm going to take you back and put you on the throne because you'll do what I want you to do. So now he's putting brother against brother back in Egypt, all right? So 24 says, he shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his father's fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey, the spoil, and riches, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. Well, here's what happens. Antiochus IV retaliates and plunders some of the richest parts of Egypt's territory. He appears to divide plunder among his soldiers, but his grand plans against Egypt's strongholds last only for a time. That was the end of the verse. It was only for a time he was successful. And by this time, he had gained control of everything from the Mediterranean to India. So he's almost a second Alexander at this point, as far as his accomplishments go. Okay, 25, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south, against the Ptolemies, with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. So now he's going to try to conquer Egypt with his army, Antiochus IV. Ptolemy VI eventually works out an agreement with his brother, Ptolemy VIII, in which they would split the kingdom of Egypt into two parts and reign jointly. And this is what you see with Ptolemy VI, is he's like, he goes to Antiochus and he gets help, but then he runs back to his brother and he joins him for a while, but then they start losing, so he runs back to Antiochus again. He seems to be the coward of this whole thing. And they unified against Antiochus IV, but he came into Egypt anyway, and he lays siege to Alexandria. Okay. 11:26, yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him. The people that feed of the king of the south's meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. So he was supposed to be under the protection of Antiochus IV. He was the one that was the prisoner. He was supposed to have a deal with him. He turns on that because all his advisors say, no, you can rule this, we can beat him. And so his advisors are the ones that encourage him to go do this, and then he gets beaten by Antiochus. Everybody still with me? I know it's getting complicated. 27, and both of these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, both Ptolemy and Antiochus. And they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. So Antiochus IV and Ptolemy VI made a covenant to regain control of Egypt from his brother, but neither king intended to keep the covenant. We just got lying and politics and stuff going on everywhere. Can't really relate to that in America today, but you know, it's kind of the same thing. While their alliance had initial success capturing Memphis, it failed to capture all of Egypt. Ptolemy VIII continued to rule in Alexandria, and later on the two brothers get back together again and manage to hold the fort for a little while and manage to repel Antiochus. So this is Antiochus' first attempt to take Egypt. He wins for a while. He takes a lot of stuff. He's very successful, but he can't quite seal the deal, and he has to go back home. Okay? And in 28, then shall he return into his land with great riches. He's taking all his spoil back from Egypt. Going back into Syria would be his homeland at this point. And his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. So on the way back to Syria, guess where he has to go by? He goes right through Israel. Okay? So that's number one. And he returns with Egypt with great plunder. Several years earlier, he had accepted a bribe from a Jewish priest named Jason, all right, which should just be a red flag, because there's no Jewish priest named Jason. Okay? It's a Greek name. Okay? That doesn't work. Okay? So a Jewish priest named Jason bribed him and said, get rid of this high priest, let me be high priest. And Antiochus had installed him as high priest. Remember, we talked about the corruption of the priesthood back in Daniel chapter 8. Jason was eventually removed because another dude came and paid a bigger bribe, and his name was Menelaus, another Greek name. Okay, so two guys that aren't really devout Jews are fighting over the priesthood based on who can spend the most money. Okay, so he is put into place. And when Jewish representatives came before the king with their complaint, hey, you can't put these guys in our priesthood, Antiochus just killed them, okay, and kept his guy in power. Okay, that's turning against the Holy Covenant. According to Maccabees, he dealt ruthlessly with the Jews, killing 80,000 men, women, and children, and plundering the temple. The Jews were infuriated at the brutality of this ruler and began a full-fledged rebellion, and that's going to become known as the Maccabean Revolt. Okay? So when he comes back through and he installs non-Levitical priests into the high priesthood, the Jews revolt, and they can't put up with that. That's the straw that breaks the camel's back. Okay, 1129, at the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south. Attempt number two at Egypt. Okay. Antiochus IV is not satisfied with the loss he took in Egypt. He didn't, you know, at least a draw. He came out with a lot of money, but he didn't get the land. So he's going to go back into Egypt. And it says, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. So this isn't going to go the same way for him. And so when he gets back down there, he invades it again. He traps the two Ptolemaic kings, the 6th and the 8th. Right? The one that loves his mother and the sausage boy. They get trapped in Alexandria. And this time, he gets beat, and the reason why he gets beat is because Rome shows up. The brothers had made a deal with Rome, and when he comes back in, they call up the Romans, and the Romans come pouring in, and they're the ones that push Antiochus back. Okay, so it doesn't end up like it was before, and he's no match for this rising Roman army that's going to become the dominant force in the world. In verse 30 says, for the ships of Chittim, that is Crete, but that is Roman territory, so these are Roman ships. Okay, shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return. So he gets his butt kicked, basically, right? And he's upset about it, right? And it says, and he's going to return. He's going to come skulking back home with his tails between his legs, or probably just one tail, between his leg and legs and two legs, and he's going to come back. And he's going to have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. So you want to know why he's really upset. Number one, he's lost already. But there are several of the early historians that tell this story, that Antiochus IV was defeated. The Roman commander was Gaius Papilius Laenus, and he met Antiochus IV outside Alexandria and handed him a letter from the Roman Senate saying, you got two choices. If you stay here, we're going to bring the whole wrath of Rome down on you, and you won't leave here alive. Or you can go home and no harm, no foul. Okay? You can face us, or you can leave. That's the thing that lays out. And so, to make this even more humiliating, like if that wasn't, as I'm this big egotistical commander, I've got to face that. To make it more humiliating than that, look at what the general does to him. This is what it made me think of. Okay? He drew a circle around him. This is the story from the historians. He drew a circle around him, and he said, before you leave this circle, you make your decision. And so, you'll talk about humiliating the guy. Okay? And if you've seen Inside Out, you know that she puts her in the sadness circle and doesn't let her leave. So he says, you need to decide before you leave the circle. And Antiochus, defeated, says, I'll leave. And he leaves Egypt. Now again, what's he got to do on the way home? He has to go through Israel. And now he's upset. Now he's irritated. So we stay with the theme. He's angry. Okay? And to complicate all that, when he gets back through Jerusalem, the Jews are in full revolt because of the whole priesthood thing. Because what had happened was Jason went and got a bunch of people with him, because remember, he got deposed. He got replaced by Menelaus because Menelaus paid a bigger bribe. He went and got a whole group together, and now two false priests are leading a revolt against each other and fighting in the countryside there in Israel. And, you know, he comes back and says, all right, I'm not dealing with this. This is going to end right now. And he's going to do some things here. So in 167 BC, he turns his anger toward Palestine and he sends in his chief tax collector. His tax collector's name is Apollonius, and he sends him to Jerusalem. Initially, Apollonius is supposed to be just taking up taxes, but apparently something changes in his mind and he starts slaughtering people left and right. And he does it on the Sabbath when people are not ready to fight, and he starts killing people. He also rewarded those Jews who supported the Hellenistic policies, like Menelaus, keeps those guys in power while killing innocent people here in Jerusalem. Okay? And arms shall stand on his part, 31, weapons will stand on his part, armies shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall make the abomination that makes desolate. Antiochus IV desecrates the temple by sacrificing a pig on the altar there on the Temple Mount. He also bans, remember we talked about this, he bans circumcision, he bans possessing the Torah, anything Jewish tradition and religion related. You remember I told you the horrible story about the mothers that circumcised their children. He hung the mothers and then hung the children as well around their necks. I mean, he's a horrible person. He stops the regular temple sacrifices and he sets up a statue of Zeus in the temple. And believe it or not, that statue of Zeus looks a lot like him. That's the whole Greek-Roman system, right? They want gods that are a lot like them, but he makes them look a lot like him. And apparently, his family was an Apollo family. You worship one god as kind of your principal god in Greek and Roman structures. And he had gone against that and gone with Zeus because he wanted the biggest god and he wanted to conquer more people. That's why he can say he's Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, 1132a says, "And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries." So those that are already blasphemers, he's going to grab a hold of them and they're going to go right with him. Okay? Maccabees 1:11 through 15 describes how certain of the Jews accepted the changes of Antiochus IV and went so far as to build a gymnasium in Jerusalem. And that's not a place where you can go play basketball. Okay? It's basically athletics and all that other stuff too. But to do that in a holy city, the Jews would not have stood for that, is what we're saying there. And they wanted to seek to have their circumcisions reversed. I don't even know what that looks like. But verse 43 goes on to say that many, even from Israel, gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. So there are people in Israel that go along with Antiochus because they don't want to die. They sacrifice, they compromise, they give up all their standing to go and be on the winning side. And then the second half of 32 says, "But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits." So there will be those Jews that fall apart and compromise, and there will be those Jews that fight back. And that's exactly what we see in the Maccabean Revolt. Okay? There were those Jews who refused to turn from their observance from the law. That's the Maccabees. This turned into an open revolt when the Maccabees took up arms against the Seleucids. And that should take us back to the two stories that I told you a while back. That is Mattathias. Okay, remember, Mattathias is the old priest of the city of Modin that when they come in to do the unlawful sacrifice, he refuses. And when another priest steps up and says, "I'll do the sacrifice," Mattathias kills him and the Syrian official and takes off into the hills and kind of leads this William Wallace-like rebellion against the Seleucids because everybody's poor starts pouring into the hills to support Mattathias and his sons, right? And his oldest son is right there. Good portrait there, good little outfit. But Judas Maccabeus, Judas the Hammer. Judas is the military leader of this whole thing. Mattathias will die soon after, and Judas will lead the rebellion and ultimately purify the temple, take the temple back in 164 BC. Okay, 1133, "And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame and by captivity and by spoil many days." Remember, the Maccabeans were not successful at the beginning. They were getting beat, but they were fighting bravely, and they inspired a whole nation to come and support them. Okay, it's much like the American Revolution in that sense. The early battles did not go their way, but the fighting brought more people to that side. Since they were fighting in order to retain their Torah observances, the Maccabees initially took a stance of not fighting on the Sabbath day, and the Syrians would take great advantage of that. And finally, Mattathias has to lay down a rule from the priest and say, we're allowed to defend ourselves on the Sabbath. Because you know how these laws were getting. You couldn't even walk a fifth of a mile, let alone fight a battle. And so he has to do that. 34, now when they shall fall, they shall be hoping with a little help, and many shall cleave to them with flatteries. Well, the Maccabees were joined by a company called the Hasidim, or the Hasids. They will become the Pharisees later on. But at the beginning, they were the ones that were trying to hold on to Jewish tradition above all else. No Jewishness. Remember, Alexander was all about Hellenism and imparting Jewish culture, architecture, thought, philosophy, everything onto the Jewish culture. These were the guys that said, no way, we don't accept that. We don't conform. We're God's chosen people. And they come and fight mighty wars of Israel, all who offered themselves willingly for the law, according to 1 Maccabees. And as a result, many who had previously gone along with the changes imposed by Antiochus IV now joined the revolt. They managed to swing the people back to their side, like you're doing wrong. And, you know, maybe that gives you some hope for America. Okay, Daniel 11:35, and some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. So some of these men are going to die for the faith. They're going to fight to defend this, and they're going to die. Eventually, as the Maccabees managed to retake the temple and to purify it, to restore the worship in 164, and that's what the Jews celebrate every year when they're celebrating Hanukkah. Okay, so when you see that pop up on the calendar every year, this is the story. Okay, the story that nobody ever talks about. It's just about menorahs and dreidels and all that. Like, this is what it's about. It's about this great, you know, and then the oil lasting for 8 nights and all that kind of part of the story. But it's a real rebellion. It's the Jewish people fighting for their heritage, for their lineage, for the right to exist. Once again, that apologetic of the Jews are still here and people have been trying to wipe them off the face of the map since Abraham, and they're still here. Okay, it is a great apologetic for God and Israel. Okay, and I've said it before, I'll say it again, you know, and the reason why I can say that is because, have you ever met a Hittite? You haven't, because they aren't here anymore. Okay, but the Jews are still there. Got to do something with them. Okay, all right. Now, let's get to these last little bit here for the last 10 minutes or so. And this is the section where we're not sure if this is still talking about Antiochus or if it's talking about a future Antichrist to come. Okay, so here's our two options, because there's no clear indication of a break. Now, there is in your Bible, because you probably have a heading. That wasn't there when this prophecy was written down. So somebody decided there was a break here, but maybe not. I don't know. So one is, the section again refers to Antiochus IV and summarizes his career without regard to a chronological sequence. So it's kind of a big summary of Antiochus. We've heard all the specifics, now just a kind of a crowning, closing paragraph about Antiochus IV. Or the vision is addressing a situation that transcends the persecution under Antiochus IV, and thus the remainder of the chapter is often thought to deal with the Antichrist. Now, chapter 12, when we get there, clearly is dealing with future issues. So the question is, when does that transition happen in Daniel's vision? And we're not really sure. Okay, so we'll take a look at it, and you guys can make a judgment for yourself. Okay, verse 36 says, and the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. Now, could that apply to Antiochus IV? It could, right? He did almost every one of those things. So this is how I kind of set it up. Okay, and that's kind of small, but option one is fulfilled on the left. Option two is future on the right. So in 2 Maccabees 5:21, it says, so Antiochus carried off 1,800 talents from the temple and hurried away to Antioch, thinking in his arrogance that he could sail on the land and walk on the sea, because his mind was elated. Sounds like he thinks he's a god. Okay, so that's what Maccabees says. And furthermore, he did call himself Antiochus Epiphanes. He did think himself a god. So setting himself up a god could work. Okay, the future people will say, though Antiochus was powerful, he was able to do as he wills only up to a point, since the power of the Romans was far greater than his, and therefore this must be referencing a greater evil to come. So they're saying, well, he's kind of like that, but he doesn't fulfill it enough. He's not powerful enough. Now, I'm not sure. There seems to be some evidence there. Okay, 37 and 38 says, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. Again, that seems to be what he's doing when he names himself God. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, or the God of armies. And a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. Now, the problem there is Zeus is not a god of armies, right? If you're Greek, who are you going to worship if you want the god of armies, if you want the god of war? Okay? It's Mars and Ares, right? That's who you're going to deal with. And so maybe not quite, but, you know, if you want to win battles, why not go right to the top of the pantheon and go with Zeus? I don't know. That's not too far out of the idea. So 2 Maccabees 9:2 says, he, Antiochus, had entered the city called Persepolis and attempted to rob the temples and control the city. Therefore, the people rushed to the rescue with arms, and Antiochus and his army were defeated, with the result that Antiochus was put to flight by the inhabitants and beat a shameful retreat. And it's noteworthy that the coins of his era have the image of Zeus rather than the more customary Apollo. So when it says he worshipped the gods not of his parents or his fathers, they're saying, well, look, his fathers were Apollo's people, and he actually worshipped Zeus. This one, I tend to lean more the other way. Because Antiochus IV viewed himself as a god, and his nickname Epiphanes and coinage made clear, but it's doubtful that he fulfilled the prophecy. There's also some question as to whether Antiochus IV abandoned the gods of his fathers. What does that really mean? So it's unclear on these verses. I don't see as much of a connection in 37 and 38 as I did in 36. Okay, 39 says, thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain. Well, if it's fulfilled, Antiochus IV sold the priesthood to the highest bidder. We saw that to Jason and to Menelaus, and later in that sense. And then the strongest of fortresses seems to be a reference to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, which Antiochus IV determined to convert to a temple of Zeus, which he did for a time. Okay, and then the future is, this is speaking of a future king who will be a larger and more ultimate version of Antiochus IV, one who will truly do as he wills. He will deal with the strongest fortresses and will make his followers rulers over many. And that's where you don't get as much there. I mean, Antiochus didn't really delegate and make his people rulers over many. Will that happen with an Antichrist figure? Many interpreters see here another prediction of the Antichrist whom they connect to the little horn of chapter 7 and the ruler of 926 who is to come, okay, that we've covered. Okay, 40 and 41, we're getting there, hang with me. Okay, and at the time of the end, which is kind of an interesting phraseology there, right? At the time of the end, are we at the end yet? Is it the end of his period, or is this the end? Okay, the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. Now, here's the problem with this stuff is that we don't have a record of Antiochus doing all this. That two kings were attacking him from different ways, and these references to Edom and Moab and Ammon, that doesn't seem to come into the history. Now, there's a few relative ideas. Well, maybe they're just talking about how he went after Egypt back in the day, but it's not as convincing. Okay. We have no records of any final war with Egypt, though Jerome quotes Porphyry, that's the first time I've ever seen that guy's name, as stating that this took place in the 11th year of the reign of Antiochus IV. It's more likely that we would understand this is a summarization, so that's what they'll say. If it's all been fulfilled, then this is just a summary of Antiochus' stuff. Okay. And then number two, in the future, at the time of the end, there will be a major battle where armies will come from the north and the south to attack the powerful ruler in the land of Israel. That's the part that kind of sticks with me, is because for all the rest of this prophecy, Antiochus and all the Seleucid kings have been the king of the north. And now the king of the north is attacking him. He didn't have his own people turn against him. And so I don't see that happening. Edom and Moab and the main part of the Ammonites will escape from his hand, possibly because of their connection with Israel or because they are out of his way. But we don't get any reference to that in Antiochus' history with those three nations. Okay, 42 and 43. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Well, we know the land of Egypt did escape. You know, they almost didn't escape, but they did escape him. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Now, he did take a lot of stuff from Egypt. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. Okay, so option one, it's a summary of the conquests that he had in Egypt. But again, Egypt did escape. It's not that they didn't escape. And prior to his departure from Egypt, Antiochus had looted the country, so that's where all the riches are coming back with him. Or this is a reference to a future battle in which the Antichrist will conquer Egypt and loot the land. Okay, so one of the two. 44, but tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore, he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. So, option one, Antiochus left Israel in 164 because he had to go deal with the Parthians out east, who became kind of the big thorn in the Roman side later on. Or, it's a reference to a future battle where the Antichrist will go out and fight these nations. Okay, and finally, verse 45, and he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. So, number one, though he had successfully conquered Jerusalem and the holy mountain, Antiochus IV eventually met his defeat and death, which is true. Or it doesn't fit with the known death of Antiochus IV. Now, here's the problem with that, is I found three separate accounts of Antiochus IV's death, and they were all different. So we don't really know how he died. There are a lot of different stories on how he died. They may be looking for a greater fulfillment that's yet to come. The Holy Mountain should be connected with the fall of the Antichrist and the Battle of Armageddon. So here's the death of Antiochus. Josephus says that God punished him because he desecrated the temple. And he dies of sickness during this Parthian campaign, a lot like how Agrippa dies in Acts 12, that all of a sudden he's just struck with this sickness and he dies. Okay? The scroll of Antiochus, which is a little bit of a later document, but the scroll of Antiochus said that he fled to the coastal cities, and everywhere he went, everybody harangued him and yelled at him and called him traitor and false guy and all this other stuff, and he got so depressed he drowned himself in the ocean. Okay? And then number three, in 2 Maccabees, it says he was fighting in a battle and the Lord struck him with this incurable disease and he fell out of his chariot and died. Okay? So we don't know how he died. So that makes it a little bit difficult to apply these prophecies right to the guy when we don't know exactly how he died. Okay? So it's hard to be totally dogmatic and definitive on these prophecies when we have conflicting information from the histories, not from the Bible itself, but from the people that are trying, the secular guys that we can always depend on. They can't agree on this. So what do we do with that, right? So it leaves us a little bit open to all this other stuff. So maybe it's both. That's the other possibility here. That some of this is fulfilled by Antiochus, but some of it will come later. Okay? Maybe that's what's going on. So it's your choice. I'm not going to tell you what way to think. I thought the old knight from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade would be a good idea here because he's guarding the Holy Grail. But there is no way to definitively. I can't stand here and tell you it's definitely that. It's without a doubt. It's definitely that because you think about these dual fulfillments, and dual fulfillments don't make us all that happy because it gets awful complicated. But for example, think about Peter in Acts chapter 2. He quotes Joel and says that this has been fulfilled. The Spirit has come and it's been fulfilled. But do you see what the rest of Joel says when he quotes it? It talks about the sun turned to blood and moon to sackcloth and all this stuff. Like, that stuff didn't happen right there in Acts 2. And yet Peter says it's been fulfilled. And yet we can't see that being fulfilled right there. And so there must be more to come. And so could something be fulfilled partially through Antiochus and again later? Absolutely. So it becomes very complicated at that point to decide where you want to fall on that. And here's what we have to guard ourselves against is you can't let your system of belief impact how you interpret these scriptures. Because if I am just a diehard futurist, well, then I'm just going to always say future. Well, that may not be the most honest way to approach the text. If I'm a diehard preterist, I'm going to say this is all fulfilled and it doesn't matter. But then, again, I'm going to run into problems here and here. So it'd be better to sit here and be honest with the text and see what the text can tell me. Here's what I can tell you about the text. There will be an abomination of desolation. There will be this. There was a man that did this. It seems to be that there's going to be more of this in the future. And when you get to texts like this, I think most people just kind of give up. they just don't study it. We've talked about it for the last few weeks. Guys don't preach this stuff. Find me another church in the last couple months around here that have preached through Daniel 11. They're not going to do it. They're just going to skip right over it. They're going to hit the hot button issues and then, the stuff that's kind of popular, and then they're going to move on. And so in our commitment to preach through the whole book, here we are in chapter 11, kind of banging our heads against the wall a little bit. But we're doing our best to dig into the scripture. Are we Bereans or are we not? Okay? I mean, that's the philosophy. So I hope that wasn't too bad for you with all that history. I know I was going 100 miles an hour. Okay, I know I kind of had to do that. And again, I left out 31 slides, so or 35 slides. So just imagine what you could have done if I would have given you all 100. Okay, so maybe that will give you a little bit more insight as we go into chapter 12, and maybe that'll flow in and you'll be able to make some connections back. But that's the goal, to be able to see this big picture. All right, let's close in a word of prayer. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for this time and the ability to have this time to teach and to study your word, Lord. And I pray that it would be fruitful. I pray it'd be beneficial and applicable as we study your word, as we are Bereans, as we're committed to knowing what your word says. And Help us to be graceful to one another when we find disagreements here, and let us be true to the text. Let us be true to what you've given us here in your word, and that we can honor you and honor your word above all else, Lord. That's all we want to do here. And thank you for giving us this time, for bringing people out to be a part of this. Again, Lord, bless our teachers as the school years get started, and we give you all the glory for it in Jesus' name. Amen.